And it's a small example, but it's sort of the same point you're making. Like, I have created this little thing that I can control, and all I've got to do is wash dishes, or all I've got to do is copy, and there's this kind of Zen purity in it, Zen perfection in it, and any time, like, that gets disturbed, I'm unhappy. So at first you think, like, wow, Bartleby's a prophet of the age to come. You know, Bartleby was a great teacher. But as we talk more, I get the feeling, you know, Bartleby is a selfish person.
Yeah, he is. Yeah. Santayana suggested...
Just one thing. I think you're perfectly right. He's saying there's no love in the world. And that's wrong. There is love in the world. In his world, there's no love. But love is what, you know, is as real as hate or whatever. It makes... I'll leave it at that.
I think the interesting thing about Bartleby is that everybody identifies something about him.
You said he's missing the other half.
And yet I don't...
That's right. There is another
Everybody's sort of throwing things at him. You're saying he's saying this. Mm-hmm. You're saying he's saying that. Mm-hmm. I don't see him saying much of anything except I prefer not to. I don't see him being nihilistic. I don't see him being... I don't remember what other terms people have used, but, you know, the futility... Where do we see the futility? He's just him.
So we've been sucked into the narrative game.
We're all imposing our own views on what Bartleby means.
Right.
And you're belittling him. You're belittling Bartleby.
Well, I'm
not you. I mean, when we talk, we're talking as though Bartleby were small. Yeah.
But I mean, we're being sucked into the same game that the narrator is doing. You know, the narrator feels revulsion, right?
The only thing we know about him is he's thrown a spanner in the works, you know, in that little society there. You know, and he's done it by, you know, in this passive kind of way that doesn't fit in with the mores of how these people operate.
Pete the dishwasher may have had a good thing going. I was thinking, Santayana says that, this is maybe 100 years ago, that what a philosopher should do is to work in a museum taking care of people's umbrellas when they come in. That's the Bartleby. He thought that was a proper... doing nothing so you can have time to think about things. No, they don't have a real occupation.
Can we deal with this point that you two are raising? Because I think it's kind of interesting. And it dovetails with this point whether that he is, in a way, rejecting love. Okay, I mean, I'm very aware, as I even say anything definitive, it's like I should keep my mouth shut. Because anytime I say anything definitive when discussing this work... You know, the work makes you feel like a fraud. It makes you feel like a narrator. It has this magical ability to reveal your own BS to you. It's an amazing work, you know, that way, you know. But this notion that the love thing, like, at a certain point, the narrator says, and, you know, I want you to leave. And Bartleby says, I do not want to quit you.
Yes, I thought that was very interesting.
So, at that moment, when I read that, I said, that's a kind of expression of love.
I thought it was from Brokeback Mountain.
I thought it was like, it was from Brokeback Mountain line. Exactly. No, it's like...
And that's how you lifted it.
Yeah.
You stole it from
Melville is amazing, isn't he? Yeah. But, so, again, like, we could say, yes, he's loveless or doesn't want love, but then these things come out, and it brings me back to the question then, like... Is there something in this opaque man who has very minimal things he does that he wants us to learn? Or if we go about trying to do that, are we always going to fall into the trap that we've now fallen into?
I don't think he wants us to learn anything.
Bartleby's not a teacher. Is that what you think he might be a teacher? Is that what you're suggesting? He doesn't seem to have any doctrine.
Right.
These reveries are without...
But if we just be with him, it's also a trap, as the narrator has said. Yeah. Like, it's a trap, too, to do nothing. So the question is, what is that moral universe that Bartleby presents? If it's a universe of just rejection, it leads to the grave. It leads to the grave. That's the direction that is heading. So what is Bartleby asking us to see? Like, is there a way of action that makes any kind of sense for humans?
We can't be Bartleby's, that's clear. Although Bartleby had a savings bank.
No.
The narrator says, I found his savings bank. Mm-hmm. He had saved some coins wrapped up and stuck way in the back of mm-hmm. one of these...
And he didn't spend it. He didn't put it out any money for rent.
So he did take care of the Morrow in some sense, but it was a hidden way of doing it.
He bought ginger nuts.
The narrator.
He bought ginger nuts.
Yeah. Yes, yes. But that's not.
And cheese.
That's
they
not major
cheese.
Substance.
You know,
right,
you may have been right about us because it suddenly occurred to me Melville has a maddening way of doing this. You scratch the surface of something and then you wind up facing something totally opaque and then you wind up projecting yourself onto it and he doesn't tell you. And that's maybe what's happening here. We're trying to figure out Bartleby and you can't figure him out.
Well, it struck me when there's somebody in my office I know somebody like Bartleby. It's like everybody knows somebody like Bartleby all of a sudden. But do we? I mean, I thought the same thing. Okay, I know.
Well, I feel like I'm Bartleby in parts. I mean, I feel like as a young person, like that was a very delicious thing to do. To reject. There was a real intense pleasure in not participating, and sticking with that as long as you possibly could, until what happened? Well, with me and a lot of people, like the force of society becomes overwhelming. And you're pulled back in. And what's staggering about Bartleby is that he is just insensitive. Or not insensitive. He just is on that path. That path to the very end where he's crawled up staring at the wall in the tombs. Like, right. That to me is in some way heroic.
But he doesn't want anything. Which is maybe to a Buddhist is heroic, but I'm not sure.
Maybe it's heroic, but it is lifeless and loveless. I mean, I was looking at that passage where he says, I would prefer not to quit you. But then you jump forward a little further in the narrative, and I'd forgotten this, that the narrator actually says, why don't you come home and stay with me, and I'll try to study it. Mm-hmm. And he says, I would prefer not to do that either. I would prefer not to engage, I would prefer not to accept your love, is how I'm reading it.
Yeah.
And maybe that is heroic, but it's heroic in an inhuman way.
Well, he certainly rejects all human connection other than sharing the office with the narrator.
Washing the dishes.
The narrator has to also come up with ideas and then accept them or reject them. And so he has a false reverie or a false epiphany, right? Yes, Bartleby, stay behind your screen. I thought I shall persecute you no more. You are harmless and noiseless. At last, I see it. I feel it. I penetrate to the predestinated purpose of my life. I am content. And so he has this ecstasy for a moment, and then it leaves. It leaves. It's manic depressive. If anybody's manic depressive, it's a lawyer.
But in some ways, that leads us to some interesting question that I think is gnaws at me as I said in the introduction when I sent out the email about this reading, you know, against the backdrop of the financial crisis. I was thinking about how this connects to Wall Street, and I was struck by that what takes the narrator out of the false hope, false serenity, is that his peers... say, hey, you got to get this guy out of here. It's wrecking the narrator's business. He's losing money. He's going to go out of business. There's a mob coming. It's gotten to that point.
Or he's losing face.
Or he's not just losing face. He's literally in trouble. Like, he could be in physical trouble with the mob coming.
The mob coming is from the second level.
Before that, there is a sort of lost face thing, right?
There's a lost face, but the mob thing is later.
But it's still
the
like...
The mob thing is...
But all of that operates to wreck the narrator's serenity. Like, at some point, you can't... His solution can't work.
His comfortable society opposed to being comfortable anymore.
So if you're going to follow the path of Bartleby, you've got to let it all go. You've got to give up caring about society. You've got to take that risk of losing your business. If that's the path you're going to follow, that's it. Now,
why is allowing Bartleby to be there following Bartleby's path? You've taken a jump there that I'm not following. He had the serenity by saying, okay, I'm going to let it be, and it will be good for me.
He's making a choice, right? The choice would be...
But how is that following Bartleby's path? That's the way you phrased it.
Where you don't care about the implications of what would happen to you financially, physically, or otherwise. Bartleby, money, no, he doesn't care. You can't give him money. You can't give him anything that will... So he's being influenced not just linguistically, that's obvious. But at a certain point, the narrator becomes homeless. He goes around in a Rockaway, and he says, at one point, I slept in the Rockaway. You know, like Bartleby's having an influence on him. And he's starting to buy into the Bartleby worldviews ever so slightly.
Until, we don't know what the Bartleby worldview is. That's what I keep trying to
say. Well, it's not a... Okay, the word maybe worldview is not correct, but the way of being, would that be helpful?
Is it an attitude?
No.
An attitude.
That's too active. I think that's
too
active.
Are you saying that the narrator is losing his grip on all of the things in life that used to be important to him, appetites and pleasures and the good opinion of his fellow man? He's kind of losing his grip on that. Maybe it's not even voluntary.
But to that extent, that grip that brings him back to dissatisfaction.
Yeah.
After, you know, having felt satisfied with Bartleby, it's then, you know, losing that to all those good things, and his friends start laughing at him. They say, what are you doing with that guy there? And he's like, oh no, then his serenity is broken again.
He uses the phrase unmanned a few times at the beginning, that Bartleby unmanned him. Because of the world in which the narrator lives, is that manly men who make money and are prosperous and do things, and Bartleby pulls that out from under him. So it's an interesting word to use
But that's always been a fraud for the narrator, because he's not a manly man.
No, he's not. The very first sentence tells you that he is not.
Right.
He does keep a bust of Cicero. I mean, he's in some pale attachment to it, I suppose.
You could read a lot into that, considering who Cicero was.
The savior of the Republic, the father of the city.
But also,
this man's not that.
Also a bit of a late Republican crawler, according to some people.
Orator, too, though, right?
Yeah.
It's funny that Bartleby stares at this great orator, but it's, you know. I don't know if that's meant
to be. The Cicero sort of represents the ultimate man of assumptions, though, doesn't he? He's a kind of a lawgiver type.
Well, I wonder if it's possible that if we were to imagine Bartleby in some other... Somebody creates the circumstances in which the narrator can thrive, and the narrator is a parasite. I mean, he's just a parasite. And Bartleby, no matter what we think about him, is not a parasite. And I can almost imagine a world in which it's Bartleby who's the captain of industry, because he's the one who dares not to be bound by convention. And that's required in order to make possible the world of people like the narrator. I think the narrator sort of understands that.
But you have to want something to be a captain of industry. Too much, probably.
But you also have to be willing to suffer.
Bartleby also was... Well, I don't know how Bartleby got his job in the first place in the dead letter office. He lost that. I mean, we know that the narrator lost his position, which was a nice, you know, sinecure where he didn't really have to do anything. And he just got, like, nice money, and he lost it. And Bartleby lost his, you know, again, an administration thing. I wonder how Bartleby got the job in the first place. Just when you say parasite, it made me wonder what led Bartleby to the dead letter office. I'm just more curious about Bartleby than the narrator, I think.
And I would have called Bartleby the parasite on the narrator. Yeah, he doesn't do anything.
He's an incubus.
He sucks the lifeblood out.
But what about when the narrator interrupts Barbie on that Sunday morning? Barbie has the presence of mind, and the narrator retreats, and he waits until Barbie has... I mean, he has a certain dignity of person that the narrator does not have. Or maybe he just acknowledges that it wouldn't be fair to bust in on him in his state of disobedience or whatever. And that interaction, in which they really don't interact, because there's a door separating them, another wall, as it were, or the other walls in the story... it's Barnaby who has not the command of the situation, but he's the more important of the two. The other one is sort of realized that he, although he owns everything there, doesn't belong there. Somehow Barnaby is in his proper place.
Rightful occupant.
Rightful occupant, in his proper place.
And the narrator acknowledges that.
He takes a walk around the block three times. And then Bartleby's not there.
I thought it was interesting that Novos plainly enjoys the fact that the Hall of Justice is normally known as the Tombs, which
still is.
It seems to me.
I'm sorry, Mr. Guy, I don't think I followed the point. It's not.
Well, I seem to me it's sort of a comment on the whole. On what justice really is, it seems to me be a suggestion that the justice as we conceive it is really a tomb of some kind and a place of death.
Can we just say that those were the names of the places because they were?
Well, Melville is one of those people who somehow never mentions things by accident. Mm-hmm. It seems to
no one is the owner.
I think, if I'm not mistaken, and I would need to confirm this more carefully, he does use the word tombs. Sort of, ostensibly naively. In other words, he's just using the place name, I think, once or maybe twice. Nippers goes there or something. He doesn't qualify it in any sense. He just says he's been at the steps of the tombs. But it's when Bartleby is there, that's the first time that he takes it upon himself to explain to us that otherwise this is known as the Halls of Justice. In other words.
What do we make of the fact that Bartleby doesn't not prefer to go to the tombs? They just... I just came across this again. In his pale, unmoving ways, silently acquiesced. It's like the first time he's ever done anything.
Well, what was he going to do?
I don't know.
Because prefer not to, police perhaps. Would... yes, but...
I don't know.
I don't
that's
think
what
that the police
about.
Would put up with it.
Yeah.
They were there to take him away, and they were going to take him away. And Bartleby either had to fight them, or, you know, lie down and lie still. In some way, he had to resist. He had to do something active.
He could have gone home with the narrator. He could have gone to Europe.
But he would have had to do something active in order to not have that happen.
But it was interesting to me that the description is that at the end of the... Maybe I'm... of the inside of the tombs as being... totally quiet, completely calm, like Bartleby, really, and grassy, Egyptian. He actually tries to make us feel that Bartleby was enshrined in the tombs like a pharaoh, in a pharaonic space, and it wasn't too unpleasant. You could almost understand Bartleby preferring that to any of the other options we might have.
So it was very solitary. The other prisoners weren't hanging around there.
No caritas. No community. Mm.
There's one little thing that, as you guys are talking about this, that it just struck me too, that to come to a close. And it's to this point about whether Melville means any, you know, whether the tombs is just the tombs. I have a hard time believing that Melville doesn't have other meanings for every single thing that he says.
Were there any other prisoners in the city at that time?
I don't know, but, you know, he could have not used the tombs. He could have used some other device to make his point, you know. But at one point, Bartleby says, and I took this very literally when I read it, but he says, "I have given up copying." And now, I took that just, okay, he's given up this job. But, like, on another level, you could say, he's given up copying this world. Like, it's like he's done... It's almost like, to me, he's on a... he's on a path that goes way before he met the narrator. And like, I've now given up copying, and now it, I hate to say this, but it has a sort of, you know, fatalistic quality, you know, Christ-like, I guess you could say, almost predestined quality, where like, I've given up copying, and then now Bartleby is going to go into the last phase of his message, of his life. He's kept a few pence, a few pennies, a few coins. You know, that this is interesting. Like, he is now fully who he is. He is no longer copying. Mm-hmm. And
the idea of copying seems to me to be also somehow a reference to mass production, the life that was just coming into being among ordinary people at this time, when you spent your life making reproductions of mass-produced things in factories all day long, doing the same thing and living a life that anybody would prefer not to do. And it seemed to be part of what is behind Melville's purpose here might be to say, you know, this is a plausible way to respond to the life that the modern world offers you.
And maybe that is the only answer to, mm-hmm. right? The only real revolution that you have left is to prefer not to do the copying. Mm-hmm. Like, that's what's left. Like, well, that's your rebellion. That's the space that you have.
Mm-hmm. When I was first reading, we mentioned Dickens, and certainly there's a lot of Dickensian about this, but the other writer that sort of jumps at you is Marx. So, you know, there is the owner, there is this exploitation, there is the proletariat. You know, you can't have a better description of the proletariat than the three, maybe the fourth Bartleby. So there is another real option of revolting against all this, and that's exactly what Bartleby doesn't do.
But you can't revolt unless you know what you want.
But how do you... Now, this is where I hadn't really made the connection, but...
What about Rebel Without a Cause?
Well, maybe he's the first one.
So there could be the guy who says some sort of party, I suppose.
There's a writer today, René Girard, who... And this suddenly, when you said copying, one of the things that Girard talks about is... he talks about mimetic desire. And the idea is that we learn what it is we want by copying. The desires is not something simply that I want, but we learn it from copying other people. And in the end, that draws us into conflict with the person who wants the same thing that we want. And as you said, he's choosing not to copy. I'm wondering if there's a reading of this where we can say what he's actually choosing is to opt out of that way of learning what it is. There's no alternative to it, apparently, in this world. The alternative is simply not to desire, because all of my desires are merely copies of your desires or copies of your desires. Whereas what he's done is he's said, I would prefer not to.
Well, yeah, but he doesn't give up English language, say, which is...
He doesn't give up
what? He doesn't give up wholly the English language, which is, of course, we learn language through imitation. There couldn't be a resolutely anti-Mises life.
Well, he does say at one point,
not a plant.
I think when the narrator comes to visit him in the tombs, he says, I would prefer not to talk to you.
He says it in English.
At the end of the story, it becomes a play. I mean, literally, you have more dialogue than you can have anywhere else. Bartleby, I know you, and I want nothing to say to you. It's not I who brought you here, Bartleby. This should not be so out of place. Nothing reproachful attached to you being here. Not so sad a place as one might think. Look, there's the sky, here's the grass. I know where I am. And then you have the story, you know, you have the conversation with the grub man. It becomes this really wonderful play, more conversation than anywhere else.
Well, that's a line that I thought though was so interesting. Also, like the line, you know, I'm not going to copy anymore, is this incredible declarative. I know where I am. Like, I'm awake. I know the situation.
I know you.
You don't know where you are. I do. And
He doesn't say that.
No, he doesn't say that. He doesn't need to say that. He just says, I know where I am. I know where I am. I know the reality of the situation.
But you are adding the rest of it in your imagination.
Sure. I am.
Is that your friend? Yes. That is a declaration. Mm-hmm. Is that your friend? Not your ex-worker. Is that your friend?
Yeah. Oh, right. I mean, he thinks he's a forger. But,
yeah. Yeah, that's to get Bartleby some food, though. That's a ploy.
Well, is it, or is it the truth?
Any other questions? Or are we at the end? I don't know how the timing works here, so...
We typically go to 9.
Right. I don't know what time it is. Oh, good. Okay. The one other thing I just... I thought we'd go over is we're kind of dancing around this thing, which is... before we get to that latter part of the tombs, there's like a kind of interrogation of Bartleby where the narrator really tries to find out what it is you want to do. And he says, now one of two things must take place. Either you must do something or something must be done to you. Now what sort of business would you like to engage in? Would you like to re-engage in copying for someone? No, I prefer not to make any change. Would you like a clerkship in a dry goods store? There's too much confinement about that. No, I would not like a clerkship, but I am not particular. Too much confinement, I cried. Why, you keep yourself confined all the time. I prefer to not take a clerkship, he rejoined, as if to settle that little item at once. How would a bartender's business suit you? There is no trying of the eyesight in that. I would not like it at all, although, as I said before, I am not particular. His unwanted wordiness inspirited me. I returned to the charge. And he goes on. And then he says, Bartleby, you know, after he asks if you want to be a companion to Europe, as a companion to Europe, not at all. It does not strike me that there is anything definite about that. I like to be stationary. But I am not particular. So, the one thing I learned from this is that he wants to be definite about something, and he wants to be stationary. And death is definite, and he's stationary before the wall. So I kind of feel like after you've given up copying, is there any other possible occupation for Bartleby except for the actual occupation that he engages in the last scene of this story? Is there any other wiggle room here? Is there anything else that could possibly have satisfied this man?
Just believing other than starving himself to death.
Instead of crawling up, staring at the wall, starving.
Are you asking to try to figure out what it is that Bartleby really wants, which the narrator is totally failing to find out? Is it possible to find out what it is that Bartleby really wants to do? I'm not sure I'm understanding.
Well, that's a question, yeah.
Could we figure out something for him to do? Or are you saying, can we figure out what Bartleby wants to do?
I think both are true. I don't know.
The way I read that passageway, that passage you're getting close to the end, Bartleby doesn't want to do anything. He wants to stay stationary. He just wants to stay put.
Bartleby wants to be true. And Bartleby is saying this. I keep coming back to the dead letter. Because there were really sort of, as I was reading, there were two sets of ideas that I kept thinking about. One was vision. One was because there was that weird, you know, all the physical space is being cut off, right? And there's no perspective anywhere. And then there's this notion of motion and failed motion. So the dead letters are simultaneously things that are sent and things that go nowhere. And there are things which the senders believe are going somewhere. But Bartleby seems to have seen through that. His work in the dead letter office has shown him there is no motion. These things are dead letters. They are in fact stationary. So I'm wondering whether it's not I would prefer to be stationary, but I am stationary. All of you are stationary. You're just kidding yourself that there's some path that you're on, but there is no path. I prefer not to lie about it. I'm wondering if it's something along those lines that...
The infinitive is incomplete. You need a word to follow. Just to, no, I prefer not to... If you put a word after that, what
to lie about it.
I don't see him trying to tell you, show you truth, but when you brought the stationary point, and then we go back to the dead letters, which are on stationary, and somebody had said, Melville never uses anything without, I like to be stationary.
Somebody else talked about stationary. Was it Turkey?
I'm not saying he's trying to say this. I'm saying he's refusing to live his life in an inauthentic way. And whether or not he would say that, I'm not saying he would say that. I'm saying he simply refuses to live a life that has any sense of motion in it whatsoever.
Why does he then say, but I'm not particular?
So at least the same place.
Well, because maybe, I mean, we talked about how he might be a social commentator, like in a way, I mean, at least that's how we can interpret him. Whether he's intending that is a question we keep bringing up, but that's the effect he seems to have on us. So it's not like he has a job in mind. It's what can you, society of this time, what can you, world of this time, what presents something to me? Present to me, like he's the king, you know, like you're presenting to me an option. I'm not going out there. You come to me, present me an option. And then I will deign or not deign to do it. And as he moves, you know, this activity, his movement through the story is always people presenting to him. And he gets to decide, no, not good enough, good enough. Yes, that's good enough, good
enough.
Except
when he applies for the job.
It was volitional, wasn't it? Because that was something at that moment, maybe, that satisfied his existential path.
See, I think I really don't, being a clerk at a dry goods store is too confining to me, but I'm not particular. So I think it's that he doesn't want to give anybody any kind of a hook to say, well, if you don't want that, then what do you want? Or you want this, therefore you have to do that. I think it keeps his impermeability. You don't have any effect on me.
If you're particular, then there is a way to get to you. Mm-hmm. Because if you're particular about something, then you like it just so, then I'm going to serve it up to you just so, and you're going to like it. Then I have power over you.
Bartleby does change. He has... You mentioned volitional. Yes, he gets the job. And then at first he does his job. Then he stops doing his job. And his progression is steadily toward refusing to eat and die. And in that sense, he changes. You asked whether there was free will. To me, there is choice. And the question is, why does he choose this? And Melville says, we don't know.
And the narrator says that he's insane.
And I think I think he just doesn't
The narrator also might have a little bit of a sickness of the will. He was paralyzed. He couldn't handle this. But, you know, I think he does. There is free will there. There is a choice, and he makes these choices all along.
Yeah, I think the question that I have is preferring not to the same as not preferring to?
Yeah, prefer is the perfect word. You prefer something, that means you have a choice. Preference.
They would prefer.
Yeah.
And then he says he's not particular. Yeah. He prefers not to.
But that's an...
Again, it's not particular.
But not to read too much into it.
Oh, come on. Let's go ahead.
Let's do it anyway.
Do it anyway. I stop now.
But I am not particular. I mean, now when I read that again, it's not just that I'm not particular in my preferences. I am not particular. That is, I am an everyman. I am almost robotic. I am just a copyist. I am not particular. I am not special. The man who keeps saying, I'm not special, is treated so much like royalty. I am the man without qualities. I am the not special person. I am the everyman, you know?
Because well, he's not of this, what? As everyone else is.
He's not
of what? He's not of this. You can't point to him effectively, say anything about him effectively, because in the next moment you're modifying it or change or saying something contradictory.
Like those particles that are in two places at one time? Too observative to bring it into existence.
Why can't we say, look, there's Bartleby standing next to the wall again. He keeps looking at the wall a lot. I mean, I don't see any problem saying right. things about
his reverie is an indication of that he's not of this. We don't. It's a contents reverie in front of a blank wall.
It brings up your question on volition, your point about volition. Like, he's such an... His strategy, if you want to call it a strategy.
I don't.
Okay? If you don't call it a strategy, then you just say his essence is ingenious. Would you argue that it's ingenious and that he can't be this or that? Is that an ingenious way of being?
He's ingenious in that he can't be moved.
But he is moved. He's carried to the tombs.
Right, but he can't be made to actively do something.
Before he's carried to the tombs, he's like a bird on a banister, right? I mean, isn't that how Melville describes
it? I was thinking that he was on the banister. I wondered if
it's bird-like. Yeah, I don't know if that's character. You know, it's a strange image, but it may be from an Egyptian bird, maybe the ibis or something. I don't know what it is, but it's an odd image for Barbara. It's the first time we think of him in that way. Or a Notre Dame, one of those figures around the church.
Gargoyle,
something like that.
Well, he's so delicate he can actually sit on the banister, like as a chair, at that point.
But it kind of brings me back to your point earlier, the point about the fatalism in the work, you know, and whether the part will be, whether by volition or by essence or by however, is like a kind of civil disobedience, a kind of Gandhian nonviolence. We're going to project all this stuff onto him. But for a while, he affects change. He changes those people in his environment. He's effective. But in the end, he ends up dead. The narrator is back telling his story, and the order of things have not changed.
Right. Mm-hmm.
He did not change this world of Wall Street.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Or am I making way too big a statement
but
there?
But the narrator has not changed.
Okay, that's what I want to know. How do you think he's changed? At the beginning of the story, as he's retelling the story, how has he changed?
I think several people said that now he had not recognized people by souls before. He'd not sought out souls. Yeah. Now he was looking for souls. Now he's looking for meaning in Bartleby, as we all seem to
be. And we don't know whether he ever will again.
He's in mourning. And he said, and what has he lost? He's lost his friend. I believe him when he says, is that your friend? Yes. And he's in mourning. He has a friend. And he had workers before he had employees, but now he has a friend. And he knows he has a friend because he's lost it, and he's in mourning.
And he's a storyteller now, whereas before he just went about his business.
Right.
Honestly. Now he has imagination. Now his imagination has been released from the world.
Yeah.
And you know, he can see the world for the first time. Whatever it is that he's seeing, he couldn't see it before. This is his way of showing us that he's seen something in the world.
I think he's confronting the void. You know that. Those last words of despair, you know, on Bartleby, on humanity. I mean, I think that's how he's changed. Bartleby has forced him to confront the futility and superficiality on the most profound level of his existence Big E existence.
Right. I forgot about that. our Bartleby, our humanity. I forgot those last words.
But will he ever do anything different than before?
Now he's retired.
Well, his world of discourse is different. I mean, that's one thing that's clearly changed, because if you look at, you know, it's not that the old narrator doesn't seek to explain or understand Bartleby, but his method of explaining or understanding Bartleby is, something wrong with your eyes, we can set you up in this, we can set you up in this, and it's a very goal-oriented, conventional, so full of social constructs that are unquestioned and assumed. And what he comes to at the end is a way that proceeds, it seems, by metaphor and by with a certain inscrutability. I mean, the thing that is interesting about the Dead Letter Office to me is that it doesn't reveal everything. Is that there's a certain, yes, there are certain explanations you can make out about it, the same way you try to explain Bartleby, but at the end of the day, there's a poetic sense about it that seems to be the narrator seems to be awakened to that at this point, that there are things that we need to understand simply by seeing them first, and not by telling them this is what you are.
I may have to throw a contrarian point of view on our happy tidy. The narrator grows and changes. Because I mark the present tense in this story with this paragraph where he's talking about the end of the master and chancery. That is actually before he begins the story of Bartleby. And this is where he gets very emotional about something. And the paragraph reads, "Sometime prior to the period at which this little history begins, my avocations have been largely increased. The good old office, now extinct in the state of New York, of a master in chancery, had been conferred upon me. It was not a very arduous office, but very pleasantly remunerative. And I seldom lose my temper, much more seldom indulge in dangerous indignation at wrongs and outrages. But I must be permitted to be rash here and declare that I consider the sudden and violent abrogation of the office of master in chancery by the new constitution as a premature act, inasmuch as I had counted upon a life lease of the profits, whereas I only received those of a few short years."
Right.
But this is by the way. So before, but this is by the way, this is like, now he begins the story of Bartleby, but this is like the most present example we have of the man, and he's still...
Yes, he is.
This is what bothers him.
It's remarkable, he doesn't call the abrogation unjust, just premature. Right? He can't
Well, but that's sort of, not, I mean, it's what all of us would feel in his position, but none of us would write it. So, I mean, it leaves him just seeming kind of as like a naive simpleton, it seems to me.
I don't believe it. It's calling forth the memory of what you were. I'm not sure I believe that he really is so committed to that vision of himself anymore by the time I get to the end.
I was just thinking... You know, I was reading the same passage just before you were reading it, and I was thinking to myself, would, you know, he begins by saying that if I pleased, I could relate diverse histories of all these people. Mm-hmm. And my thought was, would his histories and his description of himself be the same had he written it before Bartleby or after? And I don't, you know, one way of thinking about it is that some of the insights that he has about himself, that he prefers the easy life, that he is a rather weak and silly old man, maybe aren't insights that he would have had about himself until he met Bartleby. I don't know. But the way the story is written, that certainly is one interpretation of it.
So that's sort of the two ways of reading the passage, I'm sort of putting the two together, is to say there's been absolutely no change, and what we've seen is a man who basically, when he's driven to indignation, it's because his meal train has been interrupted.
Right. And the other one
is to say, I know that I am this man, and because I've been given this gift of perspective.
Right.
If I'm a weak and silly old man, which I may well be, I really don't want to realize it. I don't know why I would. What would the point of
I don't want to see this. Say that again. I don't want to.
I don't want to recognize that I'm a weak and silly old man, especially since, you know, there's nothing much to do about it. Yes, but Socrates seemed to think that if you knew that yourself, you would act better.
Well, this wasn't Socrates Bartleby at the end finally too. I'll drink that.
There's kind of a middle. There's a possibility for a middle road. You know, I sort of think there's a great passage in Ian Forster's Art of the Novel where he talks about flat and round characters, and he gives the example of Lady Bertram, who's a perfect, you know, Mansfield Park, who's a flat character, but when the dog is lost, she rises up, you know, and she sort of rounds out. And then he says, then Jane Austen flattens her again. So maybe he has like a little moment, you know, that's good. A round moment, and then he gets flat.
Very good.
I like that. But if he is a metaphor for the desiccating quality of his occupation and of perhaps Wall Street in general, it's sort of, to me, I can kind of feel that there's no way out. Like, there's no frickin' way out. Like, the system is going to incorporate the Bartlebys of the world.
No.
And go on? Is that one way to look at it? Or the change is not going to be that the occupations are changed at all. You're still chopping wood and carrying water. That, you know, nothing has changed visibly, but that you are changed. That's the change. The change is always in the consciousness. The change is always in the reflection. Or I don't know where it appears.
It's almost like Marx's portrait of the alienated worker.
Yeah, one thing I was thinking, you said something how you thought he was like possibly like some sort of Christ figure, and I was thinking, well, he's the modern parody of the Christ figure, because in the modern world, that's all that can exist of the Christ figure is a parody of that.
In some ways, it's a negative image, because one thing I was thinking, you can't imagine Christ saying, no, I don't want to go to your house for dinner.
And same with Socrates, actually, you know.
But I would say, in contradistinction to what you said, that the world will always spit out the Bartlebys. They may have a period of time where they survive, but in the end, the world will spit them out and keep on going.
Well, Bartleby is actually the transcendent response to the world, but those will not be the people who propagate, who procreate of children. You know? We need the turkeys and the nippers. More fertile and deluded folk.
Well.
Did you enjoy it?
Very much.
I did. Yes. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Wonderful reading.
Thank you.
Wonderful. Very wonderful. Yeah, thank you. I love this story. Yeah.
It's kind of too bad they don't read that St. John's. It's so modern. You know.
In the summer classics, you can read it. They did a short story as a novel.
Everybody been to Santa Fe recently?
I go there every summer to do a week. But
so I'm going to India with Krishnan Venkatesh.
Oh, wow, that's wild.
I haven't met him, but I've been
contacted by
email.
You know, when I was in the middle of the seminar, I started thinking a couple months ago, I watched a movie on TCM. It was like a Kurosawa movie that was like the one made after Rashomon about this guy who works in an office.
Oh, isn't that wonderful?
But it's like he's almost kind of like Bartleby, but he takes the path of activity instead of passivity, and he decides
to. Akira?
I'm pretty sure, yeah.
Yeah, Akira.
He's dying.
Yeah.
And
he decides to take the path of activity and get the damn playground built. You know,
at the end, he's shrinking.
Yeah.
In the show.
But he's like the mirror image of Bartleby.
Yeah.
If you've ever seen the movie Being There, I think that's kind of a Bartleby.
Zelig.
Yeah. The guy who plays him is the leader of the Shamrock.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
For that matter, Office Space.
I thought it was my mom before. I think it was kind of movie she liked.